This is The Guardian.
Today, the Supreme Court has ruled on Scotland's future. Where does it leave the independence movement? It was a tense and long-awaited moment. But the result was unanimous. Scotland's First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, had gambled on the Supreme Court, allowing Scotland to hold another vote on whether it should go independent. But on Tuesday, the Supreme Court judgment was unequivocal. Holyrood did not have the legal right to act without the approval of Westminster. Sturgeon was disappointed.
That this judgment raises profound and deeply uncomfortable questions about the basis and the future of the United Kingdom. Until now, it has been understood and accepted by opponents of independence, as well as by its supporters, that the UK is a voluntary partnership of nations.
But she wasn't defeated.
For we should be in no doubt, as of today, democracy is what is at stake. This is no longer just about whether or not Scotland becomes independent, vital though that decision is. It is now more fundamental. It is now about whether or not we even have the basic democratic right to choose our own future.
She declared that she would turn the next general election into a substitute for a referendum. For on the single issue of whether Scotland should break away from the United Kingdom. The reaction on the streets of Glasgow was mixed.
I think it's a lot of rubbish. I think this SNP are dreaming. It's all people who are power crazy, and we need the strength of the United Kingdom.
Scottish voters were divided.
There was talk there should be another referendum if there's material change, and I think Brexit has been enough of a material change, especially with part of the Better Together campaign was remaining in the European Union. So I think there's been a big enough change that could warrant another one.
But the fight isn't over yet. From The Guardian, I'm Nosheen Iqbal. Today in Focus, will Scotland vote again on the country's independence? Libby Brooks, you're The Guardian's Scotland correspondent, and you're not having the quietest day, as we can hear. Can you tell me what just happened?
Sure, I can. Well, I'm speaking to you from the Garden Lobby in the Scottish Parliament, where I've just come from a press conference, a hastily convened press conference with the First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, who was responding to the judgment from the Supreme Court earlier this morning. The Supreme Court, led by Lord Reid, said that the Scottish Parliament cannot legislate to hold a second independence referendum without the approval of the UK government. Nicola Sturgeon asked her Lord Advocate, Dorothy Bain, KC, who is Scotland's highest law officer, to refer this question to the Supreme Court in the summertime. This is after four consecutive Conservative prime ministers have said no to Sturgeon's repeated requests. And what we found out this morning was that, as far as the justices at the Supreme Court are concerned, the Scottish Parliament does not have the powers to hold that referendum without the UK government's consent.
Libby, the Supreme Court wasn't ruling on whether Scotland should have a referendum. So what was it deciding and why?
That's right, Nosheen. Under the Scotland Act 1998, which set up the Scottish Parliament, certain matters are reserved to the Westminster Parliament, and that includes defence, for example, and also constitutional matters. Now, the Scottish government was arguing that if they were to hold a referendum on independence, it would purely be advisory, and so holding a referendum was, in fact, within the Scottish government's powers. But the Supreme Court justices disagreed with that. They said that it was very obvious that a referendum on independence would have a huge impact on constitutional matters, on the union.
Libby, Scotland's First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, held a press conference almost immediately after the ruling was announced. You were in the room. What was the mood like?
I mean, certainly there was a great deal of anticipation to see how Nicola Sturgeon and the SNP were going to respond to this.
First of all, while I am obviously very disappointed by it, I do respect and accept the judgment of the court.
And I think what I would say is that, you know, if you had at the beginning of that day, you had that one question before the Supreme Court settled sort of pretty unequivocally. But actually, what Sturgeon said at her press conference ended up sort of opening up a whole new tranche of questions that we don't have answers to.
The court was not asked to decide if there is a democratic mandate for a referendum. The mandate and the parliamentary majority for a referendum is quite simply undeniable. Nor was the court asked if Scotland...
She really emphasised what she described as the unsustainable democratic deficit that was sort of brought out by the Supreme Court's judgment, you know, arguing that the Scottish government had a mandate, a parliamentary majority to have an independence referendum, and that was sort of simply undeniable. And yet the UK government, as far as she's concerned, continues to block that. She then said that she was left with no option but to put the question of independence to the Scottish electorate at the next general election.
We must and we will find another democratic, lawful and constitutional means by which the Scottish people can express their will.
She describes this as a de facto referendum. She continually emphasised the fact that proper referendum, as was held in 2014, was absolutely her preferred option.
So while it is, I think, a statement of the obvious that this is not the outcome I hoped for, it does give us clarity. And having that clarity sooner rather than later allows us now to plan a way forward, however imperfect that might be.
But this denial of Scottish democracy, as she characterised it, could not be allowed to stand. And therefore, the question had to be put to Scottish voters as soon as possible. And as far as she's concerned, that should happen at the next general election. Now, this raises, as I said, a whole range of practical questions. You know, what question would the SNP actually put to voters? Is it, you know, sort of possible, reasonable, legitimate to have a general election on a single issue? What would other parties, opposition parties, have to say about it? What would a win look like? She's previously suggested that might be over 50% of votes from pro-independence party. She wouldn't be drawn on this today. And she said that the detail would be worked out by a special SNP conference, which would be convened in the new year.
Well, Libby, for the British government, the question of Scottish independence seemed settled in 2014 when 55% of Scotland voted against it in a referendum. But it is an issue that's never really gone away. But why has it gained so much momentum now?
Nicola Sturgeon has made this question around the denial of Scottish democracy really sort of key to her argument for why she wants to hold a second referendum. And I think that is something that UK opposition parties find very hard to answer, because it is the case that the SNP government has won sort of successive elections, both at the UK level and at Holyrood, on a platform that foregrounded holding another referendum. It is the case that the Scottish voters are sort of split 50-50 on the question. But I think, you know, some of the questions that Sturgeon is putting are very difficult to answer.
And has the case for independence and who supports it changed since the 2014 referendum?
I think that's a really interesting question. I mean, the context around independence has changed markedly, not least because of Brexit. As you will recall, Scotland was the only part of the UK to vote with the majority to remain within the EU. But beyond that, I think it's really difficult to overestimate the impact of successive Tory governments on the way that Scots feel about the union. I think particularly Boris Johnson's administration, not just the scandals of Partygate, but also the way that that Johnson handled the whole pandemic, his very sort of bombastic, sometimes even jokey style, contrasted so significantly with Sturgeon, who spoke to the nation at press conferences on a daily basis, talked to the public and said that she was going to treat them like adults and give them the information that they needed to sort of help make decisions for themselves, and who I think was just seen to be a more humane and sometimes cautious, but I think so, most people felt legitimately so, leader through that pandemic. And I think that also gave Scots a flavour of what their country going it alone might look like on a more permanent basis.
Libby, why was Brexit such a turning point?
I think Brexit was a turning point for a number of reasons. Let's not forget that during the 2014 referendum, one of the arguments made on the unionist side was that in order to stay within the EU and maintain sort of international standing, it was best for Scotland to remain within the UK. And obviously that was completely turned on its head 2 years later. And I think Brexit also changed the complexion of voters in Scotland who would consider independence as an option. What we saw was that there was a sort of move across from people who had voted no in 2014, but then who had voted remain in 2016. And that tranche of voters, many of them sort of have ended up considering independence as an option subsequently.
And what arguments are now being made by those wanting to stay with the United Kingdom to keep Scotland as part of that union?
I think this is another issue that the UK government really wrestles with, is that there hasn't been any sort of great consistency of approach in putting the case for the union. And certainly that's a charge that can be levelled at the Labour government as well. Certainly, it is the case that in the last year, Scottish Labour has seen a new leader, Anna Sarwar, who has been polling far, far better, both personally and as far as his party is concerned. In fact, it was interesting that sort of most recent polling suggests that it's Scottish Labour that has reaped the benefits of the chaos at Westminster over the last few months, rather than the SNP. In fact, Anna Sarwar has just walked past me as I was talking about him, and I couldn't see if his ears were burning or not.
Coming up, how is Westminster pushing back against the relentless pressure from Nicola Sturgeon? Libby, you've managed to find a quieter space. So let's go back a moment to the 2014 referendum on Scottish independence. Now, that was bitterly fought and divisive. And I wonder if from your reporting, you find that there is a public appetite for going through all of that again.
So I'm speaking to you now from the Scottish Parliament, where I don't know if you can hear, but there's the scuttle of bagpipes outside as pro-independence campaigners meet to rally after the Supreme Court judgment this morning. They're apparently going to be, I think, up to 15 rallies across Scotland this evening. And activists have been saying to me how important it is to show visibility and show that there is appetite for another referendum for independence, despite the knockback that they got from the Supreme Court. Having said that, though, obviously the sorts of people who attend rallies in the rain are not necessarily representative of the majority of voters. You know, it does seem from opinion polling that Scotland is sort of fairly evenly split now on the independence question, with some polls just showing a very, very narrow majority in favour of remaining within the UK. But when you drill down into that, the appetite for a referendum soon, that appetite is much less, and kind of around 30% or less.
Libby, how have Scottish politicians reacted to the Supreme Court's ruling and to Sturgeon's plans?
The response from opposition parties up here is pretty much as you would imagine it to be, with both Scottish Labour and the Scottish Conservatives saying that this is not the time to be concentrating on constitutional issues, but to be helping people in the sort of day-to-day issues of the cost of living crisis and so on.
Okay, and what about the Conservative government and the feeling in Westminster? Is the general consensus that this case is now closed?
Yes, very much so. There was a nice remark from a Westminster insider saying that Rishi just intends to sit on his hands now when it comes to the question of Scottish independence. I think certainly there is a sense coming from Downing Street that they welcome the Supreme Court's decision, and as far as they're concerned, the matter is closed. But there is certainly a sense that the ball is now back in Nicola Sturgeon's court. She's the one who has to come up with another route. And as far as this de facto referendum general election plan goes, they simply sort of don't recognise it. And I should imagine that will remain the case.
Well, Nicola Sturgeon did make the pointed choice of quoting former Tory Prime Minister John Major in her speech.
I don't often, as all of you know, quote former Tory Prime Ministers, but I will make an exception today. In the words of former Tory Prime Minister John Major, no nation can be held irrevocably in a union against its will.
How might the UK government plan to respond to that increasing pressure?
Well, it's certainly the case that Nicola Sturgeon has made this argument around the denial of Scottish democracy, the key plank of her reasoning for why it is essential to hold a second referendum on independence. But as far as how the UK government matches that, as I was saying, it sounds very much like they simply don't intend to talk about it. But I'm not sure how feasible that is as a long-term strategy. And I think that tends to a broader issue that both the Conservatives and Labour have, in that they have failed to put a positive case for the union, an alternative case.
What about the Labour Party's position? Has Keir Starmer indicated how he will approach the question of Scottish independence at the next election and beyond?
Well, Starmer reiterates that he is not up for any negotiation with the SNP, and we're well aware that that is a necessary electoral tactic for him. But again, I think he is going to have to go further than that, particularly if he wants to ride the wave of increasing support for Labour up here.
Libby, the Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, says that the Scottish people are more focused on the urgency of the cost of living crisis at the moment, and that there are just simply other priorities to be dealing with.
And I think that the people of Scotland want us to be working on fixing the major challenges that we collectively face, whether that's the economy, supporting the NHS, or indeed supporting Ukraine. Now is the time for politicians...
From your reporting, how true do you think that is?
I mean, it's certainly the case that Scottish voters have plenty more to detain them at the moment than simply the constitutional question. Ask any parent, for example, on Thursday, pretty much every school in Scotland is going to close its doors because of a teacher's strike. you'll be familiar with the planned industrial action across the NHS and rail services too. The Scottish Government is struggling hugely with the impact of inflation and the Conservatives' disastrous mini-budget. That said, there is definitely an appetite for doing things differently from a large tranche of the Scottish population. Although, whether that's any different from plenty of places in England and in Wales to doing things differently from how they're currently being conducted at Westminster, it is a constant complaint from opposition parties that every issue in Scotland is played through the lens of the Constitution. But, you know, that is happening for a good reason when you have 50% of people in a country wanting to break away.
Nicola Sturgeon is Scotland's longest serving First Minister, and critics say she has repeatedly promised her supporters a referendum, which she simply cannot realistically deliver. What does this ruling mean for her future?
I think the more interesting question is whether Sturgeon's heart is really in this de facto referendum plan. You know, she said a number of times at her press conference that it was absolutely not her preferred option. A referendum was. She has always made so much of the fact that the 2014 vote was, as far as she was concerned, a gold standard in terms of legality and legitimacy. And indeed, sort of turning an election into a referendum is something that she has dismissed when other people in her party suggested it in previous years. And so it is a curious thing that she is now going down this route. And I'm not sure how happy she really is doing so.
Libby, it's been an exhausting day for you, and I'm so grateful you've taken the time to talk to us. But if you were to take away anything from this whole day, what would it be?
I think it would have to be just the fact that certainly I began today ready to get a definitive answer to this constitutional question. But actually, I'm ending the day with yet more questions that I think it's going to take a longer time to get any answers to. Certainly the UK government's strategy as of a couple of hours ago to sit on their hands and hope that the whole thing is going to go away does not feel like a sustainable one, as again, I sort of listen to the chants and the bagpipes outside the Holyrood Parliament now.
Libby, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Libby Brooks. My thanks to her. Do follow Libby's reporting for more on this story at theguardian.com. And one more thing. There is a Today in Focus live event happening next week, and tickets are on sale now. Yes, me and Michael Safi will be co-hosting our first live stream show on Wednesday, 30th of November, from 8 p.m. to 9:15 p.m. We'll be joined by Pippa Crera, Emma Graham-Harrison, and Alex Hearn as we look back at the events that have defined 2022 and try to make some sense of the biggest stories of the year. And that's it for today. This episode was produced by Alex Atack, Sarah Lorniak, and Elizabeth Cassin. Sound design is by Rudy Zagadlo. The executive producer was Huma Khalili. We'll be back tomorrow.
This is The Guardian.